Good afternoon, and welcome to the Living Writers Show on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Amanda Yulee, your host, once in a while, filling in for T. Hetzel, who's your normal host. It's been a while since I've been in the chair. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here today, pre-recording an interview with an incredible writer, Ben Markowitz, who is the author of The Rest of Our Lives, shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and really one of my favorite novels that I've read in a very long while. We're here to talk about Ben's new book, which is just out from Summit Books this winter. And we're doing a bit of a preview for Ben's upcoming visit to Ann Arbor in January. This is the first of two conversations Ben and I will have. You'll want to buy the book and meet Ben and come see us and say hi at the Ann Arbor District Library, which is Friday, January 9th, in partnership with Literati. Ben, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. And you are visiting us from overseas.
I am. So I'm right now in Texas, which is where I grew up. But then shortly after I see you guys, I'm headed home to London, which is where I live now.
And a little U.S. jaunt here for the book. Well, congratulations on all that the book is doing. So thrilling to see it on that Booker list. And I'm so exciting that we get to have our own U.S. edition out this winter.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it means a lot to me.
Good. So I think, Ben, I might read just a little bit of your bio for our listeners to introduce you a bit. And then maybe you can tell us a bit about the novel. I'll start here. Ben Markowitz was born in Texas and grew up there and in London and Berlin. He studied at Yale University and the University of Oxford. After graduating, he became a professional basketball player in Germany. His 11 previous novels include Fathers and Daughters, You Don't Have to Live Like This, and The Sidekick. He has published work in The Guardian, Granta, The Paris Review, and The New York Times. He lives in London and teaches creative writing at Royal Holloway, University of London. This actually leads me to my first question, which I'll have you answer as you're answering the question about the book. Ben, do you consider yourself a British writer or an American writer?
The simple answer is I consider myself an American writer. Mm-hmm. My mom is German, and we spent a lot of time in Europe when I was a kid. And a classmate once said to me in a London elementary school, you're half German, half English, and half American. math was not his strong suit, but he was kind of, he wasn't wrong. But I hope you can hear from my voice that even after 30 years of living in London, I still sound and feel like an American.
Yeah, not quite a Texan, though, I have to say, but you do sound
American. Actually, I should say, so that the one bit of the bio that wasn't quite right is I wasn't born in Texas. I was born in California, and we moved to Texas when I was two. My dad's from New York, and my mom is German, as I say, and I grew up in Austin, which is increasingly a city full of people who come from outside Texas.
Other places, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the novel feels so American, so deeply American to me. Can you just tell us a little bit about the book, The Rest of Our Lives?
Yeah, it's about what happens to a marriage after the kids leave home. And the premise of the novel really is that when their kids were small, the wife has an affair. And the father, and it's told from his point of view, kind of gets through a bad time by telling himself that when the younger child leaves home, he can walk out on the marriage if that's what he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And then the novel starts when he drops his daughter at university, and instead of going home again, he keeps driving across America.
Yes. And he doesn't, so he had this long-held idea that he could leave when the youngest goes to college, and there's no point of pondering. He really begins to leave the moment his daughter unpacks in the dorm, right? Like it's... go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes say that he makes a deal with himself that he can leave, and I guess that's kind of true at the time, but it's not like he spends the intervening 12 years telling himself just 5 years to go, just 4 years to go, because that would make him seem like a psychopath. It's just something he had in the back of his mind, and then when he does drop his daughter off, it's not like he plans it, but he, on an impulse, realizes that he'd rather be heading west than going back to a conversation in the marriage that they had not successfully had for a while. And so instead of turning home, he drops his daughter at university in Pittsburgh. Instead of turning back to New York, which is where they live, he sets off to see various people that he has some business to, you know, to deal with, an old college buddy, his brother, an ex-girlfriend, and then eventually seeing his son in California.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what really propels the novel forward is that impulsivity. I mean, it feels very spontaneous. It doesn't feel like he's mapped this out.
He's definitely not mapped it out. Yeah.
He's not packed for any time away, right?
He's not packed. He has to go to a Walmart to buy some clothes.
Yeah.
I think impulsivity is a good word. I think part of what he struggled with in middle age was the kind of diminishing role of impulse in his life. You know, you develop routines, you have a job, you try to present a stable home to your kids, and the spur of the moment stuff kind of falls by the wayside. And so part of the release, I hope, that the novel makes him feel, and maybe the reader feel, is that he's suddenly acting in ways that he had not planned.
Yeah, he doesn't know what will happen next, and neither does the reader.
No.
Yeah, that's the fun of it. How did you come to write this? What was the origin story of the novel?
So I tend to write in the mornings and then read in the afternoons. And one afternoon I was working on a different novel. I had the opening line of the novel came into my head, and I thought, well, you should sit down and write it. So I wrote it down and then kept writing more or less the first page or two of the book. And then because I was working on something else, I set it aside, and then 6 months later, or whatever it was, I remembered that I'd written this opening to a novel, and I took a look at it, and it seemed to me that there was something there that I wanted to keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you did.
And I did.
One thing that I was reflecting on as I was reading it is how many American road trip novels exist. You and I know you're not the first to try this. But yours is, you know, to my read, extremely fresh and new and very real in ways that are, I think, profound. Just the mundane moments on a long trip were so, you made them very fascinating. But in terms of the long history of road trip novels, were you haunted by Mr. Kerouac, or did you ever read Richard Ford's Independence Day, or you know, a book like that?
I love. I think Independence Day. I think it's my favorite of the Baskin books. I like all the Baskin books. But
me
I think
too.
Independence Day is just great.
Me too. So were you thinking about that tradition of the American road trip novel, or were you thinking that you were going to do something totally different, or how did you do it? How did you do it so differently? I guess is the question.
What's a funny thing about some famous road trip novels is that they're not really road trip novels. So the one that was probably most in my mind was Rabbit Run.
Mm-hmm. Another favorite
novel
of mine. Yeah.
Which I think is, I think the whole series is amazing. And that first book is terrific. And you kind of think of it, remember it as a road trip novel. In fact, he doesn't really get very far.
Right.
And he sets out on an impulse again, drives away from his marriage, but ends up getting stuck in the tangle of American highways and having to turn back that night sets up shop in a neighboring town. So it's the road trip bit is really just a kind of dead end in the book. And what's really going on is the parallel life he lives next to the town in which he was raised. And I think that's not a coincidence. I think there's a reason road trips are hard to write, and that's because the characters often running away from the source of the plot.
Yes.
And in this case, the source of the plot is an unhappy marriage or a marriage that needs some fixing. And if you run away from it, what do you do? And so part of the challenge of the rest of our lives for me is to keep the action accumulating, as it were, so that it still seems to progress towards something, even if he's running away from the thing it should be progressing toward.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found that you were in the writing. It must have been so tricky in the writing because there are new conflicts and new scenarios unfolding every day, every hour of this trip. But at the same time, we're going back in time, and not in a corny way. I should say you did this so well to go back and examine the scenes in this marriage that led him to this trip. How did you think about weaving in all of that historical historical, I mean, all of that background, I guess.
That's, it was hard. And actually, I just want to say, because I talked about all the road trip novels that I've loved. I mean, really what made me write this book is the road trips that I've gone on. And I did a couple of important American road trips to me. One was with two of my sisters and an English buddy of mine shortly after university, and we started in Texas and headed off to California and came back. And that made a deep impression on me. But the one this was really based on, and it's kind of odd, is a road trip I took with my family, not without it, while I was getting sicker, which features in the book, shortly before I wrote this novel. This is to answer the question you just asked. Like, part of what I wanted it to feel like is not just a symbolic journey, but just a real journey in which he's going from place to place, not sure where he's going to end up, sleeping in not very nice motels. And I had in mind when I set out a few people I wanted him to visit, which would connect him to his past, which is what happens on a road trip. You stop and see old friends, and that would be a way of deepening the narrative.
Well, very, very well done. Very great storytelling. I think that we're going to take a short musical break in a moment. And then after that, Ben, I hope you'll read a little bit from the beginning of the book to give our listeners a sense of your writing and the story. So we will, we're going to go into a Tom Paxton song. Do you want to say any more about why you chose I Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound by Tom Paxton?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be clear from the song. I actually was thinking of that title as a possible title for the novel, since when he sets off, he doesn't really know where he's headed.
It's a long and dusty road, a hot and a heavy load. The folks I meet ain't always kind. Some are bad and some are good. Some have done the best they could. Some have tried to ease my trouble in mind. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, oh, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.
That's a beautiful song. I love it. I sort of want to hear the whole thing, but we don't have time.
It is a nice song, isn't it?
So yeah. Beautiful. Do you have something that you're ready to read for us, Ben?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the opening pages that I talked about, and I'll just read what I wrote that afternoon. When our son was 12 years old, my wife had an affair with a guy called Zach Zersky, whom she knew from synagogue. He was a little younger, 3 or 4 years, had 3 boys, all younger than our 2 kids, but was, in some sense, in the same position as my wife. They both had partners who made good money, which meant they didn't have to do much and got bored and restless and maybe even depressed. Zach's wife was head of oncology at Westchester County. I saw Zach touch Amy's hand under the fold-out table at the Purim Food Bank drive under the paper cloth. He was short, about 5'8", broad-shouldered and dark. He wore linen shirts open at the chest. His chest hair had started going gray. On Sundays, he played guitar for the kids at Temple Beth and taught them Jewish songs like Spin, Spin, C'est Vivant, very pro-Israel in a tree-planting, happy, clappy way. He was the kind of guy who danced with all the old ladies and little pigtailed girls at a bar mitzvah so he could also put his arm around the pretty mothers and nobody would complain. Even before I saw them holding hands, I didn't like him. My parents are Catholic, but my dad thought religion was just a big fancy dress party, and he hated fancy dress. Maybe this is why I never got involved in the synagogue, which meant Amy had a whole social network where she had an identity, and I didn't. She told me about Zach after I already knew, and after it was already over. Amy had highly developed guilt feelings, which were so strong she couldn't help being mad at whoever she felt guilty toward, which was often me. She said she wanted to make me mad, too. She just wanted some kind of reaction. That's all she was looking for, but that's not really my style. If there's something you can do to fix something, I try to do it. But in this case, I wasn't sure what. She said, "You don't feel anything about anything." I said, "Everything I do for you and the kids. Nothing else matters to me." "So what do you want to do?" I asked her. "Do you want a divorce?" But she didn't want that, at least not until the kids had left home. The home and the kids were all she had to show for the last 12 years of her life. The thing with Zach didn't mean anything. It was more like a kind of self-harm. She knew that I knew that when she was a teenager, she used to cut herself on the thigh, a bid for attention. But Amy's a person who tells stories about her motives and actions, which are very persuasive to her as well. So it's sometimes hard to talk about or even work out what's really going on. You fall in love with somebody when you're 26, and you see them in all kinds of different lights and according to their potential, but after years and years of marriage and shared parenting and all the other shared decisions you have to make just to get through the days, you accumulate a lot of data about that person that after a while just seems more or less accurate. If you continue to have illusions, that's your fault. So if you stay married, it's because you've accepted that this is what they're like and what your life with them is like. And you stop expecting them to do or give you things you know perfectly well they're unlikely to do or give you. It's like being a Knicks fan. But I also made a deal with myself. When Miriam goes to college, you can leave too. Maybe this was just another one of those illusions, but it helped me get through the first few months after Amy told me about Zach. And for the sake of the kids, we had to pretend that everything was fine, when, in fact, what we obviously had, even when things smoothed over, was a C-minus marriage, which makes it pretty hard to score much higher than a B overall on the rest of your life.
Beautifully done, Ben. Thank you so much. That is a segment from The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz, who is joining us here on WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, Living Writers. I'm Amanda Yulee, your host. And Ben, that so impressive to hear you say that you just sort of tossed off those few pages as a beginning, because it really does set the stakes for what all that happens in the course of the novel. You know what struck me? Oh, sorry. Go right ahead.
Go ahead. No.
Hearing that passage again, what really struck me is that is this balance that I think is a very middle-aged thing, speaking as a middle-aged person, but it's a balance of raw, vulnerable, real emotions that are there, that are vivid and huge, but then also they're balanced and kind of cut with a resigned utilitarian feeling of like, well, this is where we are and this is what we can expect. And I think that you show that really well. Is that an accurate portrayal of Tom, our protagonist?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I suppose the older you get, the more you try to limit yourself to useful feelings.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that, and it's not clear that you should do that. I also feel when I was reading it that one of the things I wanted to bring out is how at a certain point, even an act of sympathy in a marriage can be a kind of criticism or taking sides or needling. So when he says right at the beginning that his wife and Zach were both in the position where their partners made money so they didn't have to, and that made them depressed, that both seems like a real sympathy. He's tried to think his way into their position. But it also seems like a kind of complaint, and you can't do sympathy without complaint or even complaint without sympathy. They all get tangled up together.
Yeah, it's a mix. Well, it's a beautiful look at some of the realities of what marriages are, longer-term marriages are. Our mutual friend Josie sent me a quote that you from an interview that you recently did, which I'm going to read back to you. You just read your own words, and now I'm going to read it back to you. You said recently, writing a novel is a bit like marriage. You hope as you go along, you become more interested in the story rather than less. So Talk about that a little bit more. Talk about writing in connection to and in comparison to marriage.
Yeah, I guess short stories are a bit like affairs.
Okay. Taking this further.
You don't need the sustaining power. You just have to have an idea and follow it through. But I do feel a lot with novels and any kind of long book. I don't think it's just novels, any kind of long narrative, that to get yourself to start, you often have a fairly crude idea of its selling points, and you shout those a little bit to yourself to remind you why you're writing it. And then the deeper you get, in the same way that when you start a marriage, you really don't know exactly what it is you're getting into, but you have some kind of ideal that is luring you on. But you hope that the reality is more interesting than the concept. And I think usually it is, right? Reality tends to be more interesting than people's ideas, and you hope that happens with a novel and with a marriage.
Yeah, very well said. Let's talk about, you know, in the marriage, so much of this book is about this marriage between Tom, who's our protagonist, who's driving west most of the book, and Amy, who stayed home from the college drop-off. She's home in Westchester, New York, I think it is. And what's interesting about Amy for the reader is that we meet her, we see her in action in the first part of the book, and then she's not there. And we're just in Tom's head and in Tom's life. But, you know, somehow you've made Amy this very vivid, like, we know Amy really well by the end of the book. Can you talk about writing a character who's sort of, I mean, she's not absent, but in a way she is. She's not there with Tom most of the book.
Yeah. It was, so the first part of the novel was tricky. The book is divided into thirds. The first third ends with when he drops his daughter at university. And I really had one tricky plot task in that opening, which was to kind of explain why Amy isn't along when they drop off their daughter. And so I had to show Amy in action in such a way that you could understand why the night before Miri's supposed to go to college, she would get in a fight with her mom and say, you know what, maybe it's just simpler if you don't come. And the hard part there was I both needed to make Amy volatile enough that it would make sense for her daughter to say, like, I love you, but it might be simpler if you're not around for this. And make her redeemable, because the point of the book later on was to show her in a more sympathetic light.
Yeah.
So that was the challenge of the first part. And then the second, you know, the rest of the book, I don't know about you, but I often carry on conversations with people I'm close to in my head long after conversations in reality have finished. And they often go better in my head than they do in reality.
Of course,
and that's sort of what happens to Tom. He keeps talking to Amy.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe my favorite part of the book is early on, he's at a Comfort Inn. And the Comfort Inn is where their family loved the breakfast, you know, the next morning at Comfort Inn.
Yeah.
So they have this sort of, he goes to a place, an American hotel chain, that had some lore for his family, some happy mythology. And so he's kind of like setting out on his own, but then he's really inside his marital home and these traditions that he's built with his family for so long. And then he spends the night in the Comfort Inn talking to Amy, but in his head, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, I mean, this is what your book brought home to me as well, that families are essentially weird.
Yeah.
And when you're a kid, especially a small kid, you don't know that.
Right.
And then at some point you're exposed to other people and you realize that what you thought was the world is your own parents' very eccentric view of what the world should be like.
Well, I mean, every marriage builds its own little kingdom for the participants and the kids and everything, right?
Yeah, and like it's clear to me, my relation to my own kids, like my knowledge of the world is not adequate to be in a position where you're supposed to be learning from me.
right.
And right. Yet from a kid's point of view, that's all they've got at the beginning.
That's it.
And you think, why am I selling this shoddy worldview to my children?
Yeah. Well, you know, it reminds me, your character is named, I'm going to get into the name for a minute here. It's Tom Layward. Is that right?
Yeah.
Which is suspiciously similar to the word wayward to the reader's mind into yes. mine. That was on purpose, or does the word wayward feel like what Tom is, sort of inadequate and fumbling and searching?
Yeah. So the name came. So I, you know, names are hard in fiction because you want them to somehow be suggestive of the character. At least I do. But at the same time, you want them to feel kind of meaningless in the way that names are.
Yes.
And I came across the name Layward in England, where I live, and maybe this is true of parts of America too. When someone dies, their relatives or friends can give money to the local council to put up a bench in a park with their name on it. Mm. And so you go through parks in London, and you have all these benches memorializing people. Often will say something when they lived, where they lived, and what people thought of them. And I came across the name Layward. And it seemed like a nice mix of wayward, as you say, and lay, as in somebody who's kind of got a sort of amateur religious depth of relation to the world.
Yes.
So it's in a way the opposite of wayward. Like
sort of authoritative.
Somebody who goes to church and is showing up. And he's not a pro, but he's still there.
Yeah.
And I like that little tension between the driftiness and the kind of centeredness.
Yeah. Yeah, that sense of drifting and searching is really prominent in the book, but it's always tempered with some sense of authority and confidence in what he's doing, which is there too. Ben Markowitz is here joining us on Living Writers, and we're talking about The Rest of Our Lives, which is his novel out this winter from Summit Books. We are going to hear another song that you selected. I think we will do the Townes Van Zandt song for a little musical break and be back with you in a minute or two.
Well, I'm going out to Denver, see if I can't find. Well, I'm going out to Denver, see if I can't find that loving Colorado girl of mine. Well, the promise in her smile shames the mountains tall. All the promise in a smile shames mountains tall. She can bring the sun to shine in, tell the rain to fall. It's been a long time, Mama, since I heard you call my name. Oh, I've been a long time since I heard you call my name.
That was Townes Van Zandt and Colorado Girl. Thank you for these really beautiful, haunting musical selections, Ben. I appreciate
it. That's nice, isn't it, Colorado Girl?
Really nice, yeah. I feel like the last question, I read something of yours back to you. I'm going to do it again. Apologies for that. But I read an interview with you where you had said that you started a draft of this novel, and then Tom, your character, started to report on these mysterious symptoms that he had, which is, I think, kind of a comment on the unspecified decline that comes upon us all in middle age. And then in the interview, I think you said that those were symptoms you were also having as you were writing in the beginning. Can you talk about that? I know it's a personal, very personal aspect
Well,
of this.
I've gotten used to talking about it. It's my own fault because I wrote about it. So I mentioned earlier that one of the problems with the road trip plot is that you're running away from it.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that if I gave Tom some of the medical stuff that I was going through, that would be a kind of ongoing form of plot that I could sustain.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I had. And so Tom doesn't know what he has at the beginning of the book. And then by the time I finished the book, I did know. And I was going through chemo. I had a kind of lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And it really, it changed the novel quite a lot, not just in terms of plot, because it became more of a feature of the book than I had originally imagined, but also just because, as you know, if you get sick, your view of the world changes, actually, because the world behaves differently toward you.
Certainly. Were you afraid to write about your symptoms before you knew what they indicated? Because you didn't know. It sounds like you didn't know.
I know, I didn't know. I really didn't. I was afraid anyway, to be honest, because my symptoms were weird and casual enough that whenever I went to the doctor, they would say, no, I mean, basically they would say, maybe it's long COVID, maybe you're just middle-aged.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a strong sense, I mean, and my wife, too, who was amazing throughout all of this, which is why the book is dedicated to her, I had a strong sense that something was wrong. And I couldn't figure out what, and so I kept on trying to open different doors to see if somebody could tell me what was happening. And in a way, that seemed like a really useful and vivid emotional state that Tom also was going through. The strong, the analogy I have in my mind is, I don't know if you ever come back from holiday and the electricity has cut out somewhere in your house, and it means that some alarm that you've totally forgotten about is now going on at 3 a.m. every morning and you can't find it. I don't know if that's ever happened to you.
Specifically not that, but that, yeah, that disorientation and that sense that something is wrong. I think that that's infused throughout the novel, that we know things are not okay. And I think Tom, you know, our protagonist doesn't know quite how to make them right. He's trying, and he's trying to do it by traveling and by connecting with these people from his past. But he doesn't know. Well, I think it's incredibly vulnerable. I think a lot of writers who may have included the symptoms in the draft before you knew what was happening might have changed that after you knew what a serious situation you were in. But I think it's very vulnerable that you left it in.
Well, I don't know, but I just mostly when I never go anywhere and I never do anything. So writing doesn't feel very public. It just feels like it's a Tuesday morning. Yeah. It's raining outside. It's 11 a.m. and I'm sitting at my desk and thinking about stuff.
Yeah.
And I know, even though this is my 12th book, I should know where it's headed, that at some point I'll have to talk about it. But actually when I'm doing it, it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like me talking to myself.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking about this difference between a book when it's yours, when you're writing it, and then this, like, there's a big corner you turn. Suddenly it's not yours anymore in the same way.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like a book when it comes out feels like an ex a little bit.
Yeah.
Like you were once incredibly intimate with it.
And now,
And now you have a kind of public relationship with it, but you're not really together anymore.
That's, a lot of metaphors for marriage and relationships in this conversation, but that's really true.
Is that how you felt with Destroy This House?
I say this all the time, but I really, I'm very happy that the book is out in the world, but I miss it. I miss the time that I spent just working on it. It was such a special time in my life to be writing this story, and it was really... It was great. It was a great time. So I missed that.
I think that's where the relationship, like the ex thing comes in, that there's nothing like the intimacy of a relationship when you're in the midst of it and you don't have to go public with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's all yours. It's intense, and you can attribute any circumstances and feelings and things to it instead of having other people tell you what it's about.
Right. And I also think, I don't know, maybe this is more true of fiction than nonfiction. Maybe you can tell me that it also feels alive in a way that it can't later because it could still be changed.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. There's that. There's like, you can have a thought at 3 a.m. and go and change it. You can say, But yeah, once they print the books, you're kind of, you're out of luck on that part of things.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit with us about the process and the time it took you to write this. It sounds like you know, in your personal life, your health life, things were evolving and changing over the course of the writing of this. Was it a long time that you took to write it?
I don't really keep a record. Mm-hmm. I, so I, you know, I wrote the opening pages. I couldn't tell you how long it was before I got back to them, and probably from by the time I did get back to them to the end was maybe a year, and it was a year in which all these things had happened to me. Mm-hmm. I'd gotten sick, and then I was being treated. But I wanted it to. I mean, the other thing is, I actually don't remember. You know,
yeah,
I could tell you what writing it was like. I don't know if you feel this too, that it's sort of me making it up. But I feel like this flowed pretty well because I wanted it to flow.
Yeah.
I wanted it to feel like it was unfolding in a kind of real time.
The book moves so quickly. I will say that. And I don't know how you did it for a book that is really about a guy driving a car thousands of miles across the country, which is a monotonous activity for most. But the book is such a pleasure to read and such a, I don't know, it's quick in the best ways. It feels profound while it's moving ahead so, you know, propulsively. So I loved it.
Thank you.
In terms of the road trip aspect, and we were just talking about how people are receiving the book and you're in this process of talking about it, I am wondering how the book's out in the UK. It has been since, I don't know, 6 months ago, maybe.
Yeah.
How are our British readers taking to it? Is there a British road trip to tradition in the spirit of the American tradition? I'm not aware of it, but I bet there is.
No, well, so, I mean, various Brits have said to me, we don't have a road trip tradition. And I think that's not quite true. There are actually great English road trip novels. It's just they're not in cars.
Yeah.
Because you can kind of drive from one end of the country to the other in the time it would take me to get out of Texas.
Yeah.
But they're great walking novels.
Oh, wow.
So Tess of the D'Urbervilles, I think, is kind of a road trip novel. Mm-hmm. You know, the Thomas Hardy book, in which she just, you know, one of the joys of the English countryside is that you can be in one village with its own pub and church and characteristics, and you walk up a hill and you're out of the village, and then you walk another few miles and you're in a totally different village with its own characteristics and different pub and church.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of traveling through the culture as well as the landscape happens on a much smaller scale in England. And so those novels exist. Three Men in a Boat is a kind of road trip novel. Anyway, so I think there are English road trip novels that are just not in cars.
Okay. Yes, the Americans take the car culture very seriously. It's very different.
Well, it's a big place. You know?
It is a big place. Did you do any traveling to these places? You know, the book starts in Westchester and we go to Pittsburgh and then there's, is it Ohio? Is it Cleveland area? I may have that wrong.
Yeah, so I did the western part of it.
Okay.
That's what I did with my family. And actually, this summer, I'm hoping to do the eastern part with the family.
Oh, good.
And cover some of the same ground.
Yeah.
He doesn't go through Texas, but the kind of Arizona, Nevada, California stuff, we did those. And various things that happened to us in life made their way in slightly different form into the book.
Yes. Well, I have to ask you because, and let's give another promo for the next conversation Ben and I will have, which is on Friday, January 9th at the Ann Arbor District Library. In the evening, Ben Markovitz will be talking with me about his book, The Rest of Our Lives, there at the library in partnership with Literati Bookstore. Ben, have you been to the American Midwest in January recently? Do you know, are you ready for what's coming?
So, you mean it's going to be bitterly cold?
Yeah, I'm predicting. Yeah, and gray.
Yeah, I'm predicting.
Yes.
I did go to Ann Arbor once because I was writing a novel about Detroit, and a buddy of mine who's a journalist, was living in Arbor, in Ann Arbor, and so I visited him. I think it was in January.
Okay.
And we drove around. But I know I'm not in, I mean, luckily I'm in Texas now, and I feel very grateful to be out of England in December and in a country where the sun still shines, but I know that's not where I'm headed.
All right, good. Yeah, all the sunshine and the conviviality and the fun is going to be inside at the library when we're talking, but outside it's going to be brutal. We're going to listen to one more of your selections, of your songs.
One is this going to be?
This will be Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. Thank you for picking these songs. I'm enjoying them so much. So we'll have a quick listen here, and then we'll be back in a few minutes. It's WCBN-FM, Ann Arbor, Living Writers.
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars tuned good and firm feeling women I don't need my name in the marquee lights. I got my song and I got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lookinbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and Blue Eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lookinbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me, and in your high society you cry all day. Been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four-car garage, and we're still building on. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to
back to the basics of love. I like that song a lot. Ben, tell us a little bit more about these selections. The last few have been in this sort of country tradition. Distinctly Texas feeling to me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but the older I get, the mellower I want the music.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that true of you? 'Cause
I think so. Yeah, yeah. And kind of, I mean, these songs are mellow, but they're mournful too.
They are, and that line, "Nobody feeling no pain," that's such a great.
Yeah.
It's both. I mean, it's sentimental in the sense that we all have, I mean, most of us, I hope, have some sense of a place where things are okay and good and simple that we don't happen to live in, but we dream about going back to.
Aspire to it, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, but there's also something a little spooky and threatening about this idea of a place where nobody feels any pain.
It's unsettling, yeah. Yeah, that's not exactly.
I'm just looking at a map now, actually. It's about an hour and a half in the car from where I am, and so maybe while I'm here, we should drive out to Lookinbach and see what it's like. I've never actually been there. Have you been?
No. I was just in Austin a few weeks ago, but I have made very few trips to Texas otherwise. So,
what were you doing in Austin?
I was at the Texas Book Festival. So, yeah. It's a nice place. You know, because you grew up there, but somebody told me to swim in Barton Springs, and I did that. And,
yeah.
Yeah. I really loved it. It felt like a classic American city, very different from the ones I know.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the Austin I grew up in is quite different from the one that I visit now. Mm-hmm. It's gotten, my mom was saying at breakfast, I think when we moved here, it was sort of 150,000 people, and now it's around 1 million.
Yeah, it's big. Spread out, too.
And I think when I was a kid, it was just a nice campus town. At least that's what it felt like.
More like Ann Arbor, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Before it had become famous for all the things it became famous for.
Well, you guys have a lot of self-driving cars there, I noticed.
We're supposed to go to a concert tonight, and I might have my first experience of the Waymo.
There's so many there. And I go to San Francisco a lot, and I think there are more in Austin, which
surprised
me.
Yeah, I'm a little scared of it.
Yeah. Tell me how it goes. I've never done it. I'm too afraid. It's not something I would do. So earlier in the show, I read your bio, and we completely glossed over the fact that you were a professional basketball player. And I need to hear a lot more about that, please.
Well, it was, I mean, to be honest, it was a kind of boondoggle. Uh-huh. I was, you know, senior year in college. I didn't want to go to grad school, didn't want to go to law school, didn't want to get a real job. I knew I wanted to write. And because of my mom, I had a German passport. And that meant not only that I could work in Europe, but that I would count as a native, because most of the European leagues have quotas on the numbers of foreigners that are allowed.
Yes.
And I had no idea if I was anything like good enough to get a job, but I figured, you know, give it a try. And so the day after graduation, I flew out to Hamburg to stay with an uncle and spent the summer trying out for basketball teams.
Now, how much basketball had you played before? You must have been on American teams in school, right?
It's a little... I'm not even really sure
bold.
How to answer that. So I played varsity basketball in high school. Uh-huh. I had a kind of split... I played a lot of basketball as a kid, and I totally loved it. But I had a sort of split identity in that when I played with my buddies, I felt like I was good, and then I wasn't socially equipped to deal with a locker room full of boys.
Oh.
And when I got in the gym on a playing for a proper team, I was mostly too scared to do anything.
Really?
And then in my college years, I kind of worked to overcome that. I mean, there were some technical, boring things about I had to adjust my jump shot, I had to put on some weight, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I played a lot in junior high and high school. When I was a junior in high school, we lived in Berlin for a year. I played on the German team, school team. We mm-hmm. won the city championship. So I had some background in it, but I hadn't really played organized basketball in 4 years when I set out.
It's a bold move to go overseas. And how was
it's
your
weird,
German?
Right?
Were you a good German speaker?
So German was kind of my first language because of my mom.
Oh.
It's very rusty now. But so my German, actually, it was odd with the German because one of the mistakes I made when I got a job in a team just outside Munich is that I admitted that I spoke German, uh-huh. and it made me a native, and so a little bit less glamorous than if I'd been an actual American.
Interesting.
And I also got stuck sort of translating between the stars of the team. interpreting, I should say.
Were the stars Americans? Then?
So the best player on our team, he was amazing. He was from San Antonio, a guy called Johnny Robertson, who had had a cup of coffee in the NBA and then bounced around various European leagues and was hoping to... Maybe he dreamed of going back to the States to play basketball, but he was about 30 years old.
Okay.
He had five kids back in Texas.
Wow. I love that you're reminding me about I'm not really a sports person, but you're reminding me about sports having this very important social aspect other than the athletic one. I think of the athletic part.
Yeah.
So you have to be both good at the physicality, athleticism part, but then you also have to figure out all the social stuff.
Yeah, and basketball is particularly relentless in that respect because you can hold onto the ball and dribble it. It's a sort of game of individualists.
Mm-hmm.
In some team games, you have a very defined role, but in basketball, you don't really. You have to kind of assert your place all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you have to work together. Yeah.
And you do have to work. I mean, it's obviously a team game, but it's a team game in which it's always up for negotiation.
Who's
what role
going to lead?
The team
yeah,
are gonna play.
And when opportunities arise, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the role of basketball and sports in the book. I mean, I found it just such a beautiful juxtaposition with the cancer diagnosis and the health and body issues that Tom is experiencing, and then his own kind of history and fascination with basketball pops up. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the last line I read in the opening section had something along the lines of, if you have a C-minus marriage, it's hard to score much higher than a B overall in the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a ball player's way of looking at the world, that your performance can be measured.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you have to come to terms with as an athlete is, what can you do, what can you get better at, and what are you stuck with? And I mean, I don't want to, just to go back briefly to my experience playing in Germany, it was the most miserable year of my life, partly because I sucked.
Uh-huh.
And I just realized, certainly as a writer, you're never quite sure how good you are or where you stand. It's a little bit vague. It's a little bit subjective.
Yeah.
It's just not in sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember we lost once in a preseason game in a kind of rundown gym in Pezinok, Slovakia. And the trouble with losing is that if you win, you can still imagine that you could be anything.
Yeah.
As soon as you lose, you think, okay, this is where we are.
This is it.
And that feeling of this is where we are is really, I think, at the heart of the book, that Tom thinks, here's my marriage, here's my health, my kids have left, this is where we are, and I'm stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. And it has that eternal quality, reflecting back the title of your book, The Rest of Our Lives. can feel, you can feel locked in. What about this sense about that you were just talking about with sports having this binary, you're winning, you're losing. How do you think about that? You teach writing at the university level. How do you think about that with your student writers and evaluating and helping them understand their work as winning or losing or where they are in that continuum?
That's tricky. That's a good question. I mean, mostly what I think it, one can easily slip in writing creatively into writing in ways that don't reflect what you actually think. So I guess in order to get away from thinking of it as a sport in which you're winning or losing, you're trying to think of it as a way of digging into your true view of the world, relations, how stuff happens. And there are all kinds of reasons that you're going to fudge it, you know, for plot, for excitement, for whatever. And so I want them to think about what they're doing as a way of getting closer to what they really think, as opposed to kind of building some weird sort of IKEA plot furniture that's going to do the job.
It's no formula. That never works.
It's no formula, no.
Yeah. And do you think, you know, you were just describing sort of an additive or a progressive path for writers. Do you think, as the author of 12 novels now, do you think they get better and better? Do you think writers improve every time?
I don't know if you improve. I mean, they're definitely, I feel like, to go back to the sports analogy, there's like, you know, an athlete, as they get older, loses some of the physical qualities and hopes to make up for it in some other thing. And I feel like I've lost some of my imaginative jumping ability as a writer, so that my early books have turns of phrase that I can't really come up with anymore, and a kind of energy I don't have anymore. But you hope to compensate with other things, maybe a clearer sense of what I'm doing. But also, I mean, plot is really hard, isn't it? And the terrible catchphrases I have when I'm teaching is that plot is the word we have to describe how something happens. And I hope that as you get older, you have a slightly clearer sense of how interesting things happen, or deeper sense, and that you can make use of that in your work.
Yeah. And that it can be more
subtle. Do you think writers get better or worse? There's probably a peak, isn't there? And then they start.
No. I think, you know what I really think is that you never know what's going to happen. And so I think that some writers have their best book is their first or second one, and then they might go on and write a whole bunch. And some writers just do get better and better and better. And I think every book is its own surprise for the writer and the reader, right? Of how things
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting subject. Because I also think that the success of a book can change what you're capable of writing.
Yeah.
I've written novels about Byron, and Byron got stuck because he had a breakout success with one of his first, you know, long poems, and it forced him to write kind of copycat poems until he broke free of it and wrote what he wanted to.
It's so there's, a terrible
curse.
There's
no separating the career from the sorts of stuff you're capable of doing.
Well, it goes back to how people receive the work and how you feel about talking about it after it's out and all of those things. I thank you so much for talking about The Rest of Our Lives with us on the cusp of its release here in the U.S. This is Ben Markowitz joining us on Living Writers, WCBN FM Ann Arbor, and I'm Amanda Yulee. We are going to, actually, I would like to ask you one more set of questions. I'm jumping all over the place between sports and everything else, but I want to talk about having adult children. And I don't know how old your children, you mentioned that you have children. I don't know how old they are.
So my oldest child, I dropped her off at university like 4 months ago.
Oh my gosh.
She just left for university. And she's actually going to be coming. She's not going to make it to Michigan, but she will be coming on part of my little tour. Yeah.
Now this is not autofiction, but we're showing, there's a few parallels. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I wrote the book before before she'd gone to university, but it's because I was thinking about that kind of stuff. That is partly why I wanted to write it.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk about, in your own life and as a writer, what that has meant emotionally? I am someone with, a teenager, and then I'm also a stepmom too. an adult kid who's married, so I feel like I have adult kids now at this point in my life, and it is a new world emotionally, and I think even as a writer, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it keeps changing, doesn't it? And you obviously get to a point where your kids are better at stuff than you are and know more than you do about various things.
Right, that's the thing. That's the weird, that may be the weirdest part, right?
Yeah, and especially since at the beginning of their lives, they don't know anything and they're not capable of anything. And so the whole relationship is you sort of helping them along. And then they come back and resist your view of the world. They don't, like, I remember, I probably shouldn't tell this story, but when we were shopping for my daughter to go to university, my wife bought her a cafetiere so that she could make coffee. And I said, she doesn't drink coffee. What are you trying to get her hooked on caffeine? And I realized that I was the father with the essentially insane view of the world, that I had become that. But you slip into that because for so much of their lives, you have to make all these decisions.
Yeah, you start making fewer and fewer of their decisions.
Right.
And pretty soon you're following instead of leading. In that process, I think that that's a process that in some ways Tom is going through in your novel, that he's relinquishing some of that control over his life. And
I think it is also important not to totally defer, and actually that comes up in the book, especially I think when we're talking, like a dad talking about his daughter or a mom talking about her son, that there can be this tendency to think, okay, this is not my area, I'm going to step away from it. And part of the novel is about Tom reacting against the way that Amy treats their daughter.
Yeah.
And not quite willing to accept that just because he's a guy, he doesn't understand what she's going through, because he wants to say, look, she's just as much like me as she is like you.
Right.
And I'm not saying he's right, but I think it's important not to just defer to the gender role.
Yeah. And the novel has such a wonderful mix of these moments where Tom is really searching, like I've said before, just wondering, what am I going to do? What's next? Who am I? You know, all of that. And then there are other moments where he's absolutely sure who he is, what he's supposed to do as a father, even what he's supposed to do as a husband and as a person. And so sometimes, and that's who we all are, right? We all have these, there are certain things that are non-negotiable. We just know and we just do them. And then there are others where we're lost.
It's one of the things I like about first-person narration. You can have a character say a lot of things, and that doesn't mean that you think he's right or she's right.
Right.
But it doesn't mean you think they're wrong either. You can just say them and see where it leads you.
See what happens. Yeah, well, that's what our readers will do. We are going to close this lovely hour with Ben Markowitz, author of The Rest of Our Lives, with your final selection, which is In Spite of Ourselves. Do you want to say anything about this musical selection, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I love, this may be my favorite song on the list, just because it's, you know, they're fractious and rude to each other, and it's loving. You know, it's just such a loving song. And that's the note that I wanted the book to end on, too.
Yeah, it certainly does. We appreciate having you here. Ben Markowitz, author of The Rest of Our Lives. He'll be at the Ann Arbor District Library in conversation with me, Amanda Yulee, on Friday, January 9th. We will see you all there. You won't want to miss this.
She don't like her eggs all runny. She thinks crossing her legs is funny. She looks down her nose at money. She gets it on like the Easter Bunny. She's my baby, I'm her honey. I'm never gonna let her go.
She ain't got legs.
Good evening. You are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Evan. I'm gonna be your host tonight for the Daily Sports Report. It's going to be our first one back from break. I'm joined by a great panel today on today's DSR. I'm joined by Paul, Andrew, Bowen, and Zach. How are you guys doing today?
Pretty good.
Oh,
pretty good.
Fantastic right now.
Living life.
How was everyone's first day of class?
It was all right.
It's pretty good.
I mean,
typical.
If I didn't have a 9 a.m. and I was up till 5 o'clock in the morning, I think it'd be better. Nice. But yeah, no, great time.
But yeah, so this is going to be at 6 o'clock, which means it's time for the Daily Sports Report. Again, you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor on 88.3. Today's topic, because we haven't had a DSR in a while, we've been gone on winter break, we're going to be doing a little bit of a college football playoff review. We're going to go over the first round of the playoffs, the quarterfinals, and then also we're going to be looking forward to the semifinals, give our takes and predictions on that. I'll open the floor. Anyone want to start? I mean, we can just go game by game, I guess, for the first round. I'll start with the first one. I think the best game from the first round, I would probably say, was the Oklahoma-Alabama game, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd say so too. I don't think that's a particularly hot take.
Yeah, I mean, it was Miami, Texas A&M was also close, but it was if you're a defensive guy, if you're a defensive football guy, that would probably be your favorite game. I mean, that was just a defensive slugfest, especially ending on the pick on the pick in the end zone. That's every defensive minded football fan's perfect way of ending a game. But personally, I just feel like the Alabama Oklahoma game was a little bit more back and forth, a little bit high scoring, just more entertaining, I'd say.
Me personally, with the Alabama game, it just kind of felt Oklahoma, like, let all their, like just all the gas went out early.
Yes.
And then Alabama just kept.